Welcome. This is Marcia for Radio Eye, and today I will be reading the October 2022 National Geographic Magazine. As a reminder, Radio Eye is a reading service intended for people who are blind or have other disabilities that make it difficult to read printed material. Please join me now for the continuation of the article I began last time entitled Afghanistan's Lost Road by Jason Matlach. That day, the Taliban announced a ban on opium from its cultivation to its use and sale. With government assets frozen and scant diplomatic recognition, the Taliban seemed to be trying to gain favor with the international community. Malawi Gul Muhammad Salim, deputy governor of Jowzjan, concedes there were problems during the last Taliban regime. A delegate at Taliban peace talks with the U.S. that were held in Doha, Qatar, he says the movement's leaders have traveled widely since the 1990s and want to engage with the world, not seal off the country as before. U.S. geologists estimate Afghanistan has $1 trillion worth of untapped minerals, enough to lift millions out of poverty if foreigners invested in infrastructure. The final stage of our journey is the 1.6-mile-long Salang Tunnel at an altitude of 11,000 feet, carving through the Hindu Kush, the mountains that divide the north from Kabul, a daring feat of Soviet engineering designed to handle 1,000 vehicles a day when it opened in 1964. The passage has degenerated into a muddy, potholed, smog-choked shaft through which as many as 9,000 vehicles drive each day. An untimely breakdown could snarl domestic trade, spike gas prices, and mean death for those trapped inside. The mouth of the tunnel is belching smoke as we enter. Visibility drops to zero. What seems like an eternity later, we emerge from the black lung and pull over to suck down fresh air before a winding descent to Kabul. There's one more detour to make to the Punjshir Valley, the fabled bastion of resistance that the Soviet Army and first Taliban government never managed to tame. Punjshir, again, held out when every other province fell in rapid succession in summer 2021, but Taliban fighters finally punctured its myth of impenetrability. The road into the valley knifes along sheer rock walls and a rushing emerald river. Billboards that once featured the late Commander Ahmed Shah Massoud and other ethnic Tajik heroes have their faces scratched out. The mood is somber in this holdout of anti-Taliban sentiment. Maybe 5 out of every 100 families are left. Only people who couldn't afford to leave, says Habibullah, a bakery owner in Unaba village. Every other shop is shuttered. Darkness, he says, is everywhere. What's left of Punjshiri resistance has retreated up the mountains. Grainy videos on social media and funerals for slain Taliban indicate they're still fighting. But for now, resistance is mostly symbolic. When we reach Kabul, a massive new Taliban flag billows over Wazir Akbar Khan Hill, a park in the city center. A gathering there has the boisterous feel of a family reunion, minus any women. Fighters from across the country laugh and take pictures, savoring their moment at the top after years in obscurity. But the Taliban's transition from guerrilla movement to government is taxing Afghans' patience. Now, new decrees are curtailing personal and media freedoms, and the nation is largely cut off from trade and aid, plunging the economy into freefall. Food, jobs, and health care are scarce. Infrastructure is a shambles. We have spent our entire lives in conflict, so I can predict the future, says Abdul Khalik, a 50-year-old laborer who lived through the Soviet invasion, the Civil War, and the U.S.-led campaign. This country will not be rebuilt for another 50 years. On our last day, we drive back to Shakabad to see Wardak, the doctor. Her fatalism on the day the Taliban banned older girls from school has been replaced by defiance. She is delivering notebooks and pens to a community-based girls' school she supports. In a private compound high in a mud-walled hamlet, miles from a paved road, girls as young as 6 are cramped together on the floor of a small room, reciting facts about the circulatory system. Wardock complains the quality of education is not good, no tests, few textbooks, but at least the girls are learning something, fueling hope that may one day they will return to school. Back at home, Wardock has something to show us. Past a grove of apricot trees and rose bushes is a hidden stone building with a vacant terrace. If the Taliban does not allow girls to go back to school, I will build one here, she declares, the vision sparkling in her blue eyes. I've made up my mind to stay and resist however I can. It is my duty as an educated woman. The next time you come here, this place will be full of beautiful voices. The next article, When the Magic Melts, by Denise Ruby. As a child, Carolyn Zanker had a magical playground from her home in the quaint Austrian village of St. Martin bei Lofer near Salzburg. She'd hike past a little pilgrimage church and up into the Lofer Mountains just below the tree line, where even hardy larches cease to grow. At an altitude of about 5,200 feet under the lofty peaks, she'd slip through a narrow portal in the limestone and crawl right inside the mountain. Prak's cave, ice cave, she says, was just like a fairy tale. Ice poured down from the cave ceiling like frozen waterfalls, and towers of it rose from the floors of corridors hundreds of yards long. Ice crystals and icicles glittered like precious gems on the walls. It was incredibly marvelous, recalls Zanker, now 58 and working as a cave guide. That fairy tale is forever lost because of climate change. Last fall, I crawled, climbed, and wriggled through Prak's ice cave for hours, directing my headlamp into the farthest nooks, hoping to spot at least a remnant of what had captivated little Caroline all those years ago. But the thermometer showed about 3 degrees Celsius, 37.4 degrees Fahrenheit. Even in the most expansive gallery, there wasn't a crystal of ice to be found. It might be time to take the ice out of the cave's official name, Zanker says. Caves form most often in limestone and dolomite, rocks that are particularly dissolvable. Over hundreds of thousands of years, water seeping down from the surface washes out shafts and branching corridors and cavernous rooms that may be large enough to hide rivers and lakes. Minerals sometimes precipitate out of the water that drips into the caves, forming stalactites that hang from the ceiling and stalagmites rising from the floor. Stretches of the Alps are rich in such caves, and some are cold enough for ice to grow inside instead of stone. No one knows exactly how many ice caves there are, but they undoubtedly are more numerous here than anywhere else. About 1,200 have been found in Austria alone, and several hundred more in northeastern Italy. Some are just open pits that trap colder, heavier air at the bottom. In others, a difference in elevation between entrance and exit points creates a powerful chimney effect. In winter, when outside temperatures drop well below those inside, the warmer, more buoyant air in the cave begins to rise and escape through higher up exits, sucking cold, fresh air into the lower-lying entrance points. That chills the cave. In summer, the air stream is reversed. Warm air sucked in at the top is chilled by the rock as it descends, and cold air blows out through the lower entrance. The chimney effect usually keeps the lower sections of the cave, where perennial ice can be found, at a relatively constant low temperature year-round. When that temperature is cold enough, water dripping into the cave freezes into mesmerizing, ever-changing shapes. Icicles many feet long or wide festoon the ceiling. Thick ice sheets cascade down the walls. On the floor, the slow drip can gradually build ice cones several floors high, or enormous rinks that seal off entire shafts. In some caves, the oldest ice dates back thousands of years. Superstitious ancestors avoided such places, believing that the cold air blowing out of them could only be the devil's breath. Others took a more pragmatic approach and used them as natural refrigerators or even to ice skate. A few simply came to admire their beauty and sketch them for early science journals. It would be impossible today to find the formations depicted in such early drawings. Too much of the ice has melted. In the progress, we're losing not just one of the planet's great wonders, but also a clue to its history, says paleoclimatologist Aurel Porcelu of Romania's Emil Rocavita Institute of Speleology. These ice caves are preserving the memory of past climate, he says, much like deep ocean sediments or the ice from polar glaciers. In Scaragoracara Cave in Romania's Albuceni Mountains, Hersolu has been climbing down a 150-foot deep shaft to reach a perennial ice block with a surface the size of 7 basketball courts. Carbon dating bat-gueno, or plant matter, trapped inside the ice tells him when it grew or retreated as the climate cooled or warmed. He has drilled 80 feet into the block without reaching the bottom, and the oldest ice samples he has taken were more than 10,000 years old. When he got that result, he emailed the lab staff to make sure they hadn't added a zero. Chemical analysis of the ice showed that most of the region's precipitation was from the Atlantic Ocean until about 5,000 years ago, when it pivoted to the eastern Mediterranean Sea. Today, another major shift is underway at Scarisoara and other ice caves in the Alps. Their ice is being decimated by warming air and increased summer rains. It's like pouring warm water on the surface of the ice, Hersolu says. In 2018, not far from Scarisoara, he found a promising new cave he hoped to study. 4 years later, when we went back, there was no ice at all, he says. It was completely melted. At a small clearing east of Austria's Gesaus National Park, paleoclimatologist Tanguy Racine zips up his cyan-colored, abrasion-resistant suit and tightens the chin strap on his helmet. It's fall, and wild raspberries dangle from the bushes around him. Above him, a woodpecker is hammering a fir tree, but he is fixated on the dark, gaping hole at his feet. A small plaque marks it as the entrance to Beilstein Ice Cave. Years ago, when Racine, a Frenchman, enrolled as a freshman at Imperial College London, he was compelled by the friendly faces at a booth promoting the caving club to join an expedition to a 20-mile-long cave in Wales. He almost got lost, and that's what hooked him. You might only be 5 meters from the entrance, but it feels like you're in a different world, away from civilization, he says. Cavers joke that their hobby is the poor man's space exploration. Hands wrapped around a rope, Racine and his colleagues from the University of Innsbruck, lead scientist Christoph Spoltel, Gabriella Koltai, and Chloe Snowling, begin to rappel into Beilstein. Gingerly, I follow suit. The woodpecker's hammering fades away. At the bottom of the shaft, we land on soft soil and lichen-covered rock, and as we continue almost horizontally, darkness envelops us. A few yards in, the spikes on our hiking boots begin to claw and crunch. We've hit ice. A drawing of this cave from 1881 shows a man raising a torch in front of a tsunami-like wall of ice near ice cones dozens of feet tall. Now all that's left is the block of ice beneath our feet. Radar surveys show that it might still be more than 30 feet thick. Along the rock wall, Racine and Snowling spot a gap where the melting ice has pulled away from the wall, creating a small shaft that leads closer to the bottom of the ice block and deeper in time. The two squeeze down, chest against rock, back against ice, and disappear. An hour later, when they pull themselves back up on ice axes and ropes, they have fresh material to analyze. This is research that couldn't be done previously and will not be able to be done in 10 years or so when a lot of the ice is gone, Racine says. Meanwhile, Koltai and Spodel have assembled a tall auger and begun drilling into the ice from the top. Bit by bit, they retrieve core samples, roughly the diameter of a coffee mug. With a miniature handsaw, Koltai slices out smaller chunks to transport back to the lab. As she drops one chunk into a sampling bag and marks the depth, a little over 12 feet, she beams at a dark bit of organic matter trapped inside the ice from a blade of grass or a leaf that washed into the cave. Radiocarbon measurements will later show it dates as far back as the 15th century. Much of this scientific information is doomed. The scientists' resources are limited, the ice caves many, and the melt rate rapid. Glaciologists already are planning to transport cores from the Alps glaciers to Antarctica, where, Pessoy says, at least for the foreseeable future, nothing can go that wrong to melt all the ice. For cave ice, too, researchers are hoping to store samples somewhere safe to preserve them for future generations to study. In the Tenon Mountains, I hike up to the largest ice cave on Earth, a place called Eisreisenwelt, or World of the Ice Giants. Less than an hour south of Salzburg, it has been a tourist attraction for a century. A door installed in 1920 at the entrance at about 5,400 feet likely has helped keep the cave cold during summers, as has a huge chimney effect. The cave exits on the plateau above are more than 1,500 feet higher. When guide Franz Reinstadler flings the door open on this fall day, the gust of wind almost blows me over. Inside, we climb 700 steps, passing ice cones and wave-shaped formations, the layers of ice ranging from white to an almost electric blue. Even here, they are deteriorating. A 16-foot thick figure dubbed the elephant no longer has a trunk. In summer, Reinstadler patrols the cave with a small caliber rifle, picking off precariously unstable icicles before they can fall on visitors. When they ask about the effects of climate change, he answers evasively. "There's so much we don't yet understand about the caves or the ice," he says. But then he adds, "It's best to visit it now. For now, among the ice giants, his breath is still freezing." The next article, A Resistance That Endures, by Paula Ramon. The descendants of people in Brazil who escaped slavery are linked by culture, religion, and resilience. Givânia Maria da Silva knows challenges. She was born in an eastern Brazil community founded by African women who were victims of the Atlantic slave trade. Like many descendants of enslaved people, Silva, 56, faced racial discrimination and worse while growing up in Brazil, the last country in the Western Hemisphere to ban slavery. She endured death threats when she was younger, often from outsiders who tried to seize the land where she and her family lived in a quilombo, one of the thousands of communities in Brazil established by people who escaped slavery. Silva went on to become the first woman from Conceição de Crioulas to earn a college degree, an extraordinary achievement in a nation where quilombo residents have long struggled for individual and property rights. It's a part of Brazil's history that is often overlooked. As a teacher and activist, Silva has devoted 30 years to researching ways to engage students and create curricula that examines the history of quilombos, the violence and oppression that have plagued them for centuries, and the vibrant culture that has thrived within them despite it all. It wasn't until 1988, 100 years after slavery was abolished in Brazil, that the country's constitution recognized the property rights of Afro-Brazilians who live in quilombos. But ownership remains rare, and obtaining land titles is still difficult. Persistent inequality and stigmatization continue to be weights on descendants of enslaved people. Abolition is told as something that brought only benefits to blacks, when in fact the way in which abolition was executed left blacks on the street, homeless and landless, says Silva, executive director of the National Coordination of Articulation of Black Rural Quilombola Communities. That remains so. Quilombos have long been symbols of resistance to bondage and oppression in Brazil. Silva says they represent the struggle to recognize the rights of blacks and the role that blacks played in the whole process of violence that began with their kidnapping from African territory. Conceição de Crioulas is in the state of Pernambuco and has about 4,000 residents. Women settled there by the beginning of the 19th century, according to oral tradition, but we don't know why they came alone, Silva notes. The largest and most famous quilombo, known as Palmares, was in today's neighboring state of Alagoas. It grew to include more than 20,000 residents, but was destroyed by Portuguese forces in 1694. The site, although no longer inhabited, is now a memorial park. Belonging to a quilombo is not primarily about the color of one's skin, Silva says. Rather, the common bond is the relationship that group established in the process of resistance to slavery. The word has taken to mean a group of people who fight, who resist, who reorganize. As early as 1530 and continuing for 350-plus years, ships brought more enslaved Africans to Brazil, some 4.8 million, than to any other nation in the Americas. By 1888, when slavery was formally abolished, many captives had escaped and founded their own communities. Official statistics show that an estimated 1.1 million people live in about 5,900 quilombos spread across the country. CONAC places the number of quilombos at about 6,500. Today, 34 years after Brazil recognized property rights for people of African descent living in quilombos, less than 10% of the communities have been granted protected status by the government, which would safeguard them from development similar to indigenous lands. Nearly 56% of Brazilians, about 119 million people, say they're of African descent, according to the Brazilian Institute of Geography and Statistics. Even so, the majority of leadership positions in business, politics, and the arts are held by whites. The average income of Afro-Brazilians is not much more than half that of whites, a 2020 study by the Institute indicates. That wage gap ratio has barely changed in at least a decade. In the city, the bosses want us for manual labor. We work a lot but earn very little, so it is still a slave process, says Benedito de Freitas, 42, who lives in Comunidad Remanescente Quilombola, Coal Sura, in the southeastern region of Brazil. Like those in the other 55 families there, de Freitas has ancestors who fled enslavement at the region's gold mines and settled in the jungle. If we exist today, it is because our ancestors sought freedom, he says. It is here in Quilombos where they respect black men and women, even when they are oppressed. For residents, Quilombos are an anchor of power in the push of racial justice, cultural identity, and religion. We have a diversity of expressions in religion, dance, and music, whose dimensions are connected, says historian Cassius Cruz. Roman Catholicism is the dominant religion in Brazil, but evangelicalism is gaining ground. The percentage of those who say they practice religions of African origin also has increased, according to the official figures. One of the most popular is Candomblé, which includes music, dance, and other ritual expressions. For me, it's really about ancestry, says Juliana de Santos Silva, 37. She had an evangelical upbringing in Rio de Janeiro, but her grandparents and great-grandparents practiced Candomblé. Santos Silva was introduced to it 11 years ago when she attended a ceremony to honor a deity. I was captivated by the energy and joy of the people singing and celebrating, she says, adding that the religious practices helped her mourn her father's death and gave her a special connection to her grandparents. Still, some Candomblé believers are wary of practicing openly. Places of worship known as terreiros have been vandalized, and in 2021, the Ministry of Women, Family, and Human Rights recorded 681 violations of freedom of religion or belief. Many of my friends keep religion hidden, Santos Silva says. Franklin Moreira, who belongs to a religious folkloric ensemble with African roots in southeastern Brazil's Minas Gerais, says it's important to educate others about the history of Quilombos, what they represent culturally and spiritually, and the role they have had in the growth of Brazil. We have to, with wisdom, show people that these are sacred places where our ancestry is manifested, and therefore it has to be respected, says Moreira, 30. It is an ancestral legacy that we carry, he adds. This Brazil we know with this culture only existed thanks to the strength of our ancestors. They suffered a lot. They lived unimaginable pains. That is why it is so important to keep our Quilombos alive, because they keep us resisting. Next article, these frogs melt when mating season starts. During winters in North America, most amphibians dive or burrow deep to avoid freezing, but not the wood frog. These fig-sized croakers stay put above ground as the water between their cells freezes, and they spend the season in a kind of cryo sleep. When spring arrives, most wood frogs awaken from their icy slumber with one thing on their mind, sex. Males find a pond or temporary vernal pool and call to females with sounds almost like quacking duck, says Dartmouth College's Ryan Calsbeek, a biology professor who studies amphibians' sex lives. As more males join in, the cacophony of croaks can be heard throughout the forest. Hearing the come-ons from the ponds around them, females hop toward the croaks they find most seductive. In a recent study using an advanced acoustic camera, cow's beak, determined that female wood frogs, like many humans, can't resist deep, husky voices. Such croaks tend to come from large frogs, but once a female is lured to a pond, she's fair game for all its male frogs, including small sopranos. The victor is the male that grasps and mounts the female, wrapping his forelimbs around her torso, a position known as amplexus. He squeezes until she deposits her eggs into the water. He then releases sperm, fertilizing the eggs. It's female wood frog's fate to have several breeding opportunities during their 2 to 3 year lifespan. So odds are good that they'll find at least one big baritone daddy. This article by Annie Roth. Next article, speaking eye to eye. Saying no when Fido gives you his best puppy dog eyes can be extremely difficult. For thousands of years, dogs have been cajoling people by making this pitiful, adorable expression, an ability that may be the result of selective breeding, a new study says. Tiny muscles around the eyes and mouth enable terrestrial mammals to form myriad facial expressions. Those muscles are more similar in dogs and humans than in dogs and wolves, says the study by researchers from Pittsburgh Duquesne University. In wolves, most of the facial muscles are slow twitch fibers, which adjust less rapidly, while in humans and domesticated dogs, most of the muscles are fast twitch fibers, which react quickly. It's this musculature difference that allows dogs to make puppy dog eyes and other animated human-like expressions that wolves can't. Communicating with facial cues is fundamental to all humans, says study lead author Anne Burrows. So it seems reasonable that we would have selected dogs during selective breeding that would gaze into our eyes. Burrows and colleagues are now investigating whether the evolution of fast-twitching muscles around dogs' mouths played a role in the barks they developed to communicate. Throughout the holidays that will close out 2020, may we all find ways to celebrate sustainably. Green the greenery. Each Christmas, revelers glorify live trees, but later millions of firs, pines, and spruces end up decomposing in dumps, releasing methane into the environment. Now some green-thumbed companies are renting out trees, which they tend the rest of the year. If you prefer to buy, look for local growers with advice on where to recycle. To complete the natural look, make ornaments from collected and dried foliage. Go for a healthy glow, whether illuminating the menorah during Hanukkah, the kinara during Kwanzaa, or tea lights during Diwali. Consider how the candles are created. They are often manufactured with paraffin wax, a petroleum-based fossil fuel. Affordable and cleaner alternatives include those made with soy, ethical beeswax, and coconut wax. Using artificial lights, LEDs are eco-friendly. This concludes readings from National Geographic Magazine for today. Your reader has been Marcia. If you've enjoyed hearing this content, please give us a call at 859-422-6390. Thank you for listening and have a great day.